Hello, and welcome to Conversations from the World of Allergy, a podcast produced by the American Academy of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology. I'm your host, Dave Stukas. I'm a board-certified allergist and immunologist and serve as the social media medical editor for the Academy. Our podcast series will use different formats to interview thought leaders from the world of allergy and immunology. This podcast is not intended to provide any individual medical advice to our listeners. We do hope that our conversations provide evidence-based information. Any questions pertaining to one's own health should always be discussed with their personal physician. The Find an Allergist search engine on the Academy website is a useful tool to locate a listing of board-certified allergists in your area. Finally, use of this audio program is subject to the American Academy of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology Terms of Use Agreement, which you can find at www.aaaai.org. Today's edition of our Conversations from the World of Allergy podcast series is targeted towards clinicians who treat patients with asthma as well as researchers, and I think you'll see why as we get into the subject matter at hand. And today's guest is Dr. Jonathan Bernstein. Dr. Bernstein is the current president of the American Academy of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology. He is a professor of clinical medicine in the Division of Rheumatology, Allergy, and Immunology at the University of Cincinnati, where he has a laboratory for clinical and investigator-initiated trials. In addition, Dr. Bernstein also treats patients and conducts clinical research through the Bernstein Allergy Group and the Bernstein Clinical Research Center, also in Cincinnati, Ohio. Dr. Bernstein joined us on the podcast shortly after beginning his term as the Academy President and returns today to discuss the recent consensus of an American College of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology, American Academy of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology, and American Thoracic Society work group on definition of clinical remission in asthma on treatment. Dr. Bernstein, thank you so much for taking time to join us today, and welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you, Dave, for having me.
Yeah, I think this is going to be a wonderful discussion. But before we get into the topic, you know, time really does fly by when you're having fun, and it's hard to believe, but you're already halfway through your term as president. How's everything going so far?
Well, it's going quite well. I mean, it obviously goes fast. You never know what's going to come up each day. So there's some, surprises, but nothing serious. And it's nice to be able to really see how the organization works from from the inside, and to really get a sense of, a better sense, a great appreciation of the organization and how much it really does, and to really contribute to our specialty. It's not even possible to understand that just being a member or even doing attending meetings. You really need to be in leadership positions to really understand what goes on in this organization. That's why I really encourage all of our members to really put themselves out there and to volunteer and to participate and to get involved, and I think they'll find it's a gratifying experience.
Oh, that's great. And I know it keeps you very busy. Is there anything specific that you're looking forward to before our next annual meeting in February 2024 when you'll turn the gavel over? Are there exciting initiatives or any travel coming up for you?
Well, of course, there's the November board meeting that'll be held in Washington, D.C., and certainly we have a full agenda. But of course, the program director's winter meeting where everyone gets together. There's many different meetings occurring concomitantly. I'll be attending that as well. I think that there's a lot of exciting things. The program for this year's meeting is extremely exciting. The theme is neuroimmunology. That's the presidential plenary. There are several, speakers will be talking about conditions that we commonly treat as allergists, immunologists, that are not necessarily IgE mediated, that are neurogenic, but interface with the immune mechanisms that we're very familiar with. I'm also very excited about the new program this year, the Discovery Program, which is more of a basic translational research program that will attract a lot of our young investigators and our researchers to participate. There are some newer initiatives. There's going to be the beginning, the first of hopefully several forums to come that will be discussing health disparities in different regions of the world for us to have a better perspective, not just what's going on in this country, but to understand what's going on in other countries. We are an international organization, and we certainly need to be involved in these areas as well, and be sensitive or empathetic to the problems and the issues that our colleagues have in these countries, because they don't have access to all the therapies or even the care of them that we are lucky to have in the United States. I'm very excited about my initiatives, VADIA, where volunteerism addressing environmental disparities and allergy, and that's moving along very nicely. We have almost completed a call to action paper. We've renamed the white paper the call to action, and Maha from Rush University is taking the lead on that. But we have a great group of people involved in that project. We are putting together an RFA that will actually help fund several research projects throughout the United States addressing that will allow us to implement some of these volunteerism programs addressing environmental disparities. And then we're doing some other initiatives as well. So that's coming along very nicely, and a lot going on. There's just a few highlights. So far, I can tell you that things are in good shape with the American Academy of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology, and the future is very bright.
Oh, that's great. Boy, like you said, there's a lot going on. And for our listeners, stay tuned. We will have future episodes dedicated specifically to the new Discovery Program. And then if we always have our the chair of the annual meeting program committee come on to talk about, you know, what we can expect at the annual meeting. So that's great. Well, you know, let's move on to today's topic. Let's just start. Can you just offer some background as to how and why this work group of three different organizations came together?
Well, I think there was increasing evidence that there's a need for a definition of remission. It was being used in studies, mostly industry-sponsored studies, discussing the term remission and claiming remission. It was felt that that it's important that the organizations actually really have a say in terms of what constitutes remission. So I think this was the impetus, given the importance of real-world data, real-world research, and more and more in how we approach our patients. We use this information to really to manage our patients, not just guidelines that are, you know, either Delphi or GRADE methodology, but also the real world data. So we needed to have better understanding of what does constitute remission for asthma. And so this was led by a number of individuals. This initiative began at the college. Dr. Corbett was one of the individuals who led this initiative and brought us in, which was, and then also was able to bring in the ATS as well. So it's been a true collaboration between the different organizations to develop this document.
Mm. Well, you know, traditionally, we've always been taught to focus on achieving good asthma control for our patients. How do we define and or measure good control?
Well, that's, you know, of course, we have patient reported outcome measures. You know, we have asthma control tests. We have, quality of life questionnaires. And these are all very important. And we use objective evidence. We use objective evidence, spirometry. Now people are using more and more ENO. And so really having objective and subjective evidence to establish control, you know, utilization of resources is also very important. Are people going to, are they having unexpected or unscheduled office visits or emergency room visits or hospitalizations, overusing their rescue medications? All of this contributes to morbidity and poor control and overutilization of healthcare resources. So I think there's a number of variables that we use to establish control. There are obviously, people are using prednisone four times a year. Is that control? No. And so we have to use a compilation of parameters to really establish control.
And as you mentioned, you know, we've never really used that term remission for asthma for multiple reasons. You know, it's a chronic condition. It's variable over time. And I think a lot of us have just been hesitant to tell somebody, oh, your asthma's gone away. Don't worry about your inhaler anymore. So how has remission been defined for other conditions?
Well, that's a good question, because it does have different connotations for different diseases, in terms of whether people are still taking medications or off medications. You know, is this control or is this truly remission or is it cure? And does remission mean cure? And I don't think it really means cure. So I think it means that it's very well controlled when people are in remission. And it means that patients are able to step down, but to the minimal amounts of medications necessary to maintain control, where they are not having symptoms, they're not, their lung function is well preserved, is controlled, they're not missing school, they're not missing work, they're not ending up in the emergency room. You know, all of these factors would really, this is how we've used this to really define remission. But if you're talking about cancer, you know, remission is that there's no evidence of active disease, you know, and that and patients are typically off therapy. Where, you know, the chemotherapy is depleted, or X-ray therapy is depleted, there, or they have a surgical procedure, and there's no evidence of, you know, nodal involvement or other, you know, organ system involvement, and patients are, you know, considered in remission. Does that mean they can't have a reoccurrence? No, it doesn't. But those patients still need to be monitored. So I don't think the term remission should be confused with cure.
Yeah, that's excellent perspective. And I just to touch upon some very important messages that I heard you say. So one, remission does not mean cure. Two, remission means that symptoms can come back again, which leads me to my next question as to why did the work group decide to develop criteria for asthma clinical remission and specifically include while on treatment?
Yeah, and I think that's that was a point of discussion, you know, because and I think that the group felt that, you know, remission doesn't mean cure, and that, you know, if you have someone who's extremely well controlled on a biologic or, you know, even on conventional therapy, and they're not symptomatic when they're exercising, when they get a viral infection, it doesn't induce an exacerbation. You know, these are the triggers that normally would cause problems in patients with asthma. This doesn't happen. I think that, you know, that you would say this patient is controlled now and probably in remission. However, there's if you stop all the medications, everything, will they still remain in remission? We don't have data for that right now, and we don't even necessarily have data to support the definition that we came up with. This is a Delphi consensus opinion. So, you know, we did the best we could given the circumstances as to what the current state of, you know, status is. And I think that we needed to take the lead here as an allergy immunology group, because if we didn't do this, then it would be defined for us. And since we are the people who are managing these patients, it's important that we have a say as to what constitutes remission. And the bar was set quite high. And in fact, it was very high before the final document, and we did loosen it up a little bit by allowing rescue medication, a limited amount of rescue medication more frequently than twice a year. So just like once a month or so. But, you know, the but I think generally speaking, it was important that professional organizations, the physicians who are managing these patients and other providers should really be the lead in these types of definitions.
I'm really glad you brought that point up, because I've had both conversations with other colleagues and been involved in different work groups that this has come up. And you know, the question inevitably is, well, you know, who are we to decide, you know, what constitutes remission, or why are we doing this? Because it can be problematic, as we'll discuss. And as you mentioned, this was happening with or without us. And this was an opportunity for the true asthma experts to have a seat at the table and have some say as to what goes into this. So I think that's a really important point that you brought up. The consensus document discusses the term super responder, which was actually something I had not been familiar with prior to reading this. What is a super responder, and how should we incorporate this into thoughts surrounding asthma remission?
Well, I think it really is what it says. You know, patients really do respond very well to treatment. They, you know, when they're on this, you know, it's like an amazing response. Their disease completely improves, and it's a beautiful thing to see, where patients are really kind of a mess. You know, they're overutilizing their rescue therapy. They're, you know, and they're maxed out. And, you know, you put them on a biologic, for instance, this is one example. Of course, it could also be an advancement of with triple therapy, perhaps. But most of these examples relate to biologics, and, you know, where there's an incredible response where their inflammatory parameters go down or go to, you know, to normal levels. Their clinical symptoms completely improve, and that you can even see improvement in lung function with some of these biologics. So I think, and they remain stable. So patients who are flapping in the wind are now all of a sudden, you know, boring patients. You know, they're coming now twice a year for monitoring lung function and clinical symptoms, and they're doing very well. And what we are having to, you know, one of the things I think physicians have a real difficult time doing is stepping down on therapy. We always kind of keep people on treatment and say, okay, if it's not broken, don't fix it. Stay on your medication. But many times patients, you know, taper down themselves on treatment. Well, I'm only using the inhaler once a day now, but and then you say, well, you know, you should be really using this the way it's prescribed. And then you look at their parameters and say, wait a second, you're looking great. You know, maybe you're right. Maybe we should be stepping down. So, and some have stepped off some of the other topical therapies. Now, that precludes that people are going to be staying on biologics for forever. And that's the problem that we have right now is what are the endpoints? These are treatments that help control disease or put people into remission, but they're not necessarily curative. And they don't really, you know, if you stop these drugs, at least as we see in the real world data or in even some of the clinical trials, the disease does seem to worsen and come back. So I think we still have a ways to go in terms of understanding the pathogenesis of asthma and really understanding how to truly turn it off. I think we can now get people to remission where they're very, very well controlled, but it's very difficult. We still don't have cures for this complex disease.
Yeah, and for any patients listening, to go back to Dr. Bernstein's point, we don't want you to be boring as a person, but we absolutely want your conditions to become very boring over time. I like that a lot.
Patients don't mind being boring.
No. Yeah. Change. Absolutely. Well, if it's okay. Yeah, yeah. If it's okay with you, I'd really like to, for our listeners, to help orient them, because this can be a lot to kind of digest, and we'll put links to the document as well, and you can read this on your own time. But I'd like to go through each of the six criteria individually and have you offer comments one at a time, if that's okay.
Yeah.
And it should be mentioned for our listeners that in order to consider somebody in asthma clinical remission, they need to fulfill every single one of these criteria over a 12-month period of time. So before we get into the specifics, do you have any overarching thoughts or perspective, you know, before we dissect each one?
No, I think that the definitions that we use in this document are really kind of intuitive and things that we're very familiar with in terms of outcomes data, in terms of, you know, clinical trials, you know, exploratory, primary, secondary exploratory endpoints. And now we're trying to really put this into more of a real world sense and, you know, how we use this in the clinic, because people don't operate like a clinical trial when they're managing patients.
Absolutely. Okay. Well, all right. The first criteria reads, no exacerbations requiring a physician visit, emergency care, hospitalization, and or systemic corticosteroid for asthma over a 12-month period of time. This one seems pretty straightforward. Is there anything else that we should consider with this?
No, I think it's quite obvious. You know, we don't want patients to, we want their lives, we want them to live, we want them to be able to, you know, be in control of their disease, not the disease in control of them. And, you know, just to have an exacerbation two or three times a year, think about this conceptually, every 4 months, even every 6 months, that means there's disruption in your daily life. There's disruption in your family, there's disruption in school, there's disruption in work, leisure activities. And these disruptions can last, you know, 2 to 4 weeks or longer. Some people, you know, and this results in significant burden of disease for these patients. So I think this is obviously and these are endpoints in clinical trials, by the way. So, you know, we're looking at this in terms of that's the primary endpoint, right? For biologics, no exacerbations or reduced exacerbations, not no, but reduced.
Yeah. Well, I hope our listeners are picking up on some really key words you're using here. Disruption, burden. So when we're trying to consider somebody in remission, we really want to their asthma to be, as you stated, very boring over the last 12 months. So that's great. Well, all right, the second criterion is actually a little more nuanced, and I'd love to hear some more perspective on this. And this one states, no missed work or school over a 12-month period due to asthma-related symptoms. So my first question to you is, what about somebody who has asthma and they also have influenza and they miss 2 days of work because they have coughed during that period of time? Like, how can we really apply this?
Well, I think when you look at this in the context of the normal population, if patients are behaving like someone who's in the normal population doesn't have asthma, I don't think you can call that asthma. But if they have, you know, typically the traditional asthma patient will have prolonged symptoms after a viral infection. It will, usually last several days, weeks, if it's not treated. In fact, it's common for people to have post-viral coughs where they're coming in and they're having these coughing spasms and they can't stop it due to airway hyperresponsiveness and increased inflammation. So that is what we're trying to stop and prevent. So a viral infection for 2 days, this is no different than somebody who doesn't have asthma. That's normal. And but if they have a prolonged course where they require intervention, obviously that's not remission. Now, I think when you think about work or school, it's not just missing work or school. And we didn't include this, but as you well know, the term presenteeism, where you actually go to school, but you're not feeling good, you're sick, you're coughing, you can't concentrate, you can't be efficient at what you're doing. So I think we have to, recognize that this has broader implications. We just don't want there to be associated morbidity at all in these patients that would affect these important life events.
Okay. So moving on to the third criterion. This states stable and optimized pulmonary function results on all occasions measured over a 12-month period with a minimum of 2 measurements during the year. Two-part question for this, and then any other perspective you want to offer. How often should pulmonary function tests be obtained for each patient? And then can you also clarify what is meant by stable and optimized for this criterion?
Well, as you know, there are some people who have completely normal lung function but still have asthma. They have airway hyperresponsiveness where their lung function declines and normalizes with controller therapy. But there are some people who have reduced lung function, and some patients completely improve post-bronchodilators, and others have partial improvement. And so they have some fixed airway obstruction, and that is, this is a debatable issue. Is this a patient with asthma COPD overlap or just asthma that's had, chronic disease where there's been loss of lung function over time? And now that they've been diagnosed and properly treated, you can prevent decline. The normal individual loses a certain number of cc's per year, 20 mls maybe a year, 20 to 50. Somebody who is having asthma who's losing more than that, obviously, that's what we're trying to prevent, which is the normal loss with age, irrespective of an underlying lung disease. So we monitor lung function. I personally still use peak flows, and because I can correlate the peak flow with FEV1, and if they have a FEV1, if their FEV1 is, let's say, 100% and their peak flow is 550 and they have a 550 when they come in and a visit, and I say, well, do I really want to go get another FEV1? But that being said, I think that guidelines indicate that lung function should be measured at least once a year, and if appropriate, twice a year is recommended here. Course, a consensus. This doesn't mean everyone 100% agrees, but I think you're going to have to use clinical judgment here. But at least in my mind, at least once a year. Here they're saying twice. If you're in remission, you may not see these patients more than once a year sometimes. So I really have to take this with you have to use clinical judgment, but. But the general intention is that you can't just go by an ACT. You can't just go by a patient report history. You have to do objective measurements, and patients should have stable FEV1 and FEF 25, 75. And you shouldn't be seeing significant fluctuations beyond what you would see with a normal loss of lung function with age.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's very helpful. And, you know, it's interesting, my interpretation, and this may not have been the intent of the work group, but you, if you have a stable patient and you see them once a year, that's still a 12-month period, right? So if I see them every December, I'm still getting two pulmonary function tests within a 12-month period. So that would easily satisfy those criteria.
Yeah, I think you're correct. I think that if they come in before the next fiscal year. Okay, so otherwise it's once.
Right, there you go. Right, if you're a day late, it doesn't count.
Yeah, it doesn't count. But I think you're right. I think that the intent would be to do that, and we try to also recognize that we have to be cost effective too in terms of really managing our patients. And you know, at the end of the day, we are our patient's advocate, and we're going to do what's best for them. Okay, not what's best for us. What's best for them. And this is what we do as physicians.
All right, let's move on to the fourth criteria. And this one reads, continued use of controller therapies, which includes inhaled corticosteroids, inhaled corticosteroids with LABAs, leukotriene receptor antagonists, only at low to medium dose of inhaled corticosteroid or less, as defined by the most recent GINA strategy. This one seems a little more vague. So can you just offer some additional insight regarding this criteria?
Well, again, we know the doses, you know, we have different dose ranges and there's equivalencies between inhaled corticosteroids, but you would say that, you know, there are some maximum doses of inhaled steroids. For instance, if you're using nebulized budesonide, 1 milligram per ml is a high dose. If you're using fluticasone's inhaler, 550 dry powder, that's a high dose, but you know, moderate would be, you know, 250. So, you know, these are, if someone needs to be at that high of a dose, are they really in remission? So it really provides some understanding that patients can step down to lower doses, suggesting that they don't require higher doses where there's a higher likelihood of systemic absorption and side effects. So we're trying to always use the least amount of medications to maintain control. So I think you could easily make the argument that patients shouldn't be on any medication if they're in remission, that their disease has gotten away. But again, as we talked about earlier, we are curing people. We are controlling patients extremely well so that they, none of these other factors are a problem. So using low to medium, which are safe medications, well tolerated, more affordable, cost effective to maintain remission is what is recommended by GINA. It's also recommended by NHLBI. You know, I think they both kind of agree in that area that one wants to use the fewest amount of medications, the lowest doses possible to maintain excellent control is what we're talking about.
Okay. You mentioned earlier in our conversation the use of these validated tools to measure and assess asthma control. And the fifth criteria applies to those tools. And it states that they need to have an ACT greater than 20, an ARIC less than 2, an ACQ less than 0.75 on all occasions measured in the previous 12-month period with a minimum of 2 measurements during the year. So how often should these tools be used in clinical practice? Should this be every single time a patient with asthma comes to see us, even if it's for an unrelated reason?
If they have asthma, they need to be. This needs to be recorded. These are important, validated patient-reported outcome measures that establish control. And when you're at those levels that are specified, that really does indicate that they are not having any issues. Now, sometimes patients put these numbers down and they say they're not having trouble, but then you check their lung function and they're a mess or their peak flow, whatever you do. And because there is a discordance between objective patient-reported outcome measures subjective patient-reported outcome measures and objective measurements in lung function. Because, as you know, asthma is an insidious disease, and many patients don't recognize that they're even having clinical symptoms. There's this lack of sense of dyspnea. And so this is something we have to be very vigilant about. And again, many times we see patients coming in with unrelated problems. They're focused on their skin or they're focused on some reaction they had, and they're not recognizing that their asthma might be the underlying contributing factor. And a case in point would be, you know, someone who underwent we just had a patient who had a reaction to a tree nut, for instance, and the problem was breathing issues, and she said she had no history of asthma. We looked at her peak flow that we took because it wasn't what she came in with. It was like 360, and it turns out that she had airway obstruction and significant reversibility that was not recognized. So that may not be causing her reaction to tree nut, but certainly when she has that, it's going to make her much more, the reaction is going to be much worse. Okay. It's similar to inducing anesthesia, you know, perioperatively. So I think we have to be vigilant, and I think we need to be consistent in terms of how we record this data. And the best way to do it is with these objective parameters. The important thing is trying to get these into electronic medical records. And some of these electronic medical records really should have them populated automatically when patients come in and they have a listing of a problem that's asthma. And this is the only way we can really effectively do quality improvement, and we can actually even do merit MIPS, you know, to really understand, you know, better outcomes. So these are really important for those purposes, but also, you know, obviously to really stay on top of our patients. So we underutilize them as physicians, and we need to, and this is true for any chronic disease, because we now have them for several diseases. We have them for urticaria, we have them for angioedema, we have a lot of objective, validated patient-reported outcome measures, or subjective patient-reported outcome measures.
Mm-hmm. Well, you just gave me a flashback to the first 5 years of my career where I worked tirelessly to try to get clinicians to put the ACT score into the electronic medical record with the, you know, dot phrases and automated. Oh my gosh. I guess I have some PTSD I'll work through on
it. Really needs, exactly. It really needs to be done by these EMR, the owners of these EMR systems.
Yeah. Okay, so the sixth and final criteria reads, and this is the one that's probably going to have the most conversation here, symptoms requiring one-time reliever therapy. And this can apply to a short-acting beta agonist, a combined inhaled corticosteroid short-acting beta agonist, or a combined inhaled corticosteroid long-acting beta agonist, no more than once a month. And this one seems to have generated the most discussion and differs a bit from our traditional use of the rule of twos of, you know, using your albuterol twice a week and, you know, things like that. So I'd love to hear more about how the work group came to this decision.
Yeah, and originally it was much less. It was twice a year, but there was, I think, some feedback from other colleagues that felt that that was too rigid of a criteria, because people may do it for exercise, they may do it for, you know, other reasons. So I think that, you know, hopefully we're going to get away from this idea of using SABA by itself. But right now we have the policies or the technology that we have developed and the research that we have developed hasn't caught up with policies or, you know, practical use in the clinical setting. So I think this was a compromise, and this is what Delphi's are. Again, recognize there are no randomized trials for remission. This is all expert opinion, consensus recommendations. And this was a compromise to make the, at least not to be as rigid. We see problems with short-acting beta agonist use when people are using more than one canister a month. The one puff, one or two puffs a month, is not going to result in any increased morbidity. Some people do it just out of reflexive motion because they're used to being, you know, they're worried about, you know, something that traditionally would have caused them trouble. So they use it. So you don't even know why they're using it. Sometimes it's not necessarily that they're having truly bad symptoms, but taking into account these other criteria, the patient-reported outcome measures, the objective lung function, the other endpoints, I don't think that this is, I think this is reasonable, and one could still say the patient is extremely well controlled in remission.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, so for just to kind of clarify, because I think people will probably automatically say, so if you have a patient who uses their short-acting beta agonist prior to exercise, and that prevents symptoms from occurring, and they are not having exacerbations, meet all the other criteria, they would not actually meet the definition for clinical remission, correct? Even though they're very well controlled.
If they're not, and here I missed your first point.
Well, if they're using their short-acting beta agonist several times a week prior to exercise and no other symptoms.
Right. I mean, exercise, you know, you have to differentiate exercise-induced bronchospasm from exercise as a trigger for asthma. You know, there are different mechanisms of action and there are different conditions. So if someone's running six times a week, but they have exercise-induced asthma, should they be able to forego the bronchodilator before exercise? And this would be an area that would have to be maybe some discussion. It's still possible that they could be in remission, but they're treating exercise-induced bronchospasm with the osmotic shifts in the airway. It's a different mechanism of action. Versus the bronchospasm, smooth muscle dysfunction, early inflammation pathways. So it's not something that was discussed. I mean, it was discussed, but not something that they felt that they needed to address in this particular definition. This is not a perfect document. It's not necessarily a perfect definition. This is probably a working document that may be subject to change as more data is accumulated, as we learn more about the disease. And we're learning more and more because we do have biologics that if you change the course of these mechanisms of action, these biological pathways that are involved. Based on what, the information we have at hand in our clinical experience.
Well, I really appreciate you walking through each of these criteria and offering the perspective. I encourage our listeners to read this yourself and keep this conversation in mind as you kind of look through the specific details of each one. So I have to ask you, how should clinicians utilize this in practice? Is this going to change management in any way?
Well, I think it's clear, and there is a follow-up editorial that is not from the organizations, but from individuals. It's co-authored by Mitch Grayson and Paul Williams that really spell that out, answer that question, that this is really meant for research purposes. This is not meant for clinical use. And I think your question about exercise-induced bronchospasm and using the frequent use of short-acting beta agonists is a case in point. So it's really, I think, important that clinicians recognize they should continue to manage their patients according to NHLBI, EPR4, and GINA guidelines, whichever one they find is more reasonable for their patients. And I think that at least for the mild intermittent, population, I really feel that GINA is probably more relevant for our population, but they tend to then converge more and have more in common when you start getting to the moderate to severe cases. But that being said, continue to manage patients according to these guidelines, these definitions are there. We now have something in print. And it's something that industry needs to look at when they start using these terms to lay claims to what their drugs do or don't do. I think it also starts to begin the conversation of consensus definitions, because that's one thing we struggle with. We have so many different organizations and we have so many different viewpoints that we need to have common terminologies. We need to have common definitions for key critical defining points like remission or cure or control. And we should be talking apples to apples, not apples to oranges, when we talk about our patients.
Well, I think that was a perfect summary. And, Dr. Bernstein, I can't thank you enough for spending time with us and walking through this document. I have no doubt it's going to generate a lot of questions amongst our colleagues, and I'm hopeful that this will provide more insight and perspective for them. Is there anything else you'd like to add before we depart?
No, I think this is great. I think that I'd like to see more of these initiatives where we do have, these types of inter-organization cooperations, and I think we do that quite well now, and it's nice that we have ATS involved, and that I think we're doing this now more and more with other diseases that we're treating, like urticaria and angioedema. We have interdisciplinary, interorganizational collaborations, and I think that's very important to make sure that our colleagues are not confused. That they aren't getting different messages about what they should and shouldn't do with regarding management of patients.
Mm-hmm. I'll never forget during your first podcast with us a few months ago, you mentioned that game you play with learners of all levels of you challenge them to name a specialty of which allergy and immunology does not overlap. That's fantastic.
Yeah, and I use that in a recent message too, because I think it's so important that we recognize the broad scope of practice and I think that's another thing you'll see with the next meeting is that the neuroimmunology is really speaking to that point that we have to be much broader. We have gone well beyond the early days of allergy, where all we talked about was aerobiology. Now we're talking about so much more, and not that aerobiology is not important, it is, but it's only a small part of what we do at this point.
Well, Dr. Bernstein, thank you again.
Thank you very much, Dave.
We hope you enjoyed listening to today's episode. Please visit www.aaaai.org for show notes and any pertinent links from today's conversation. If you like the show, please take a moment to subscribe to our podcast through Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or Spotify so you can receive new episodes in the future. Thank you again for listening.